From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 800-462-7413. And along with your calls, we have some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Deep breathing. Do you ever do that to calm down? That's what you're doing right now. We're going to talk about neurons in the brain, where they may be, and how mice, instead of being agitated at times, may take deep breaths before problems happen. Mice, we can learn a lot from mice.
Okay.
And the FDA, 23andMe, genetic tests, what the FDA has said about it recently and whether or not you should get it, and what are the privacy issues that have to do with genetic testing.
And a yummy recipe.
Corn and cucumber salad with feta and basil. I love corn. I love cucumber, I love feta, and I love basil.
Yeah, it all
sounds
good.
So this is a wonderful, quick, easy recipe. Lately, I've been into quick and easy versus long and complex.
Sounds good to me. 800-462-7413 is our number. As we welcome our first caller, Zorba, a listener in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi. I'm 64 years old, and I have a weird thing that I seem to have inherited from my maternal grandmother and my mother, that's made sleep problematic from time to time. I'll be awakened by the sound of a doorbell. Sometimes it's the sound of someone pounding on a hollow core door. Sometimes it's the sound of a voice in my ear. Yelling my name or other things like that. But the weirdest thing is that the doorbell thing really got me going, because I would get up in the night and, you know, run down to the door and look outside, wondering, you know, if somebody was playing a prank, or if maybe a deer was pressing the doorbell. Or
a deer was pressing the doorbell?
Well, there are a lot of deer in our neighborhood.
Yeah, but do they normally, are they selling things, going from door to door? That's what I want to know.
In the middle of the night, anyway.
That sounds like a very scary movie to me.
Yeah, no, it is. It is.
The scary thing is really when it's the voice, the voice thing, and it's clearly not part of a nightmare or a dream.
Right.
Because sometimes it interrupts dreams, and it wakes me up from a dream, and it's totally unrelated to the
dream.
What
is the voice? I want to get to the voice for a second. Is it that it's a voice? Do you know what the voice is? Is it something familiar? Is it just a scary voice, or just the fact that it's a voice that's scary?
You know, it's different things. I mean, it's the first time I heard the voice, and again, it was at a time when I didn't think much of it, because we were living in a place that had strange goings on. But
how often does it occur in a month? Is it a rare event or a common event?
It used to be maybe once every month to six weeks. But in the past month, it's been, I've noticed it, every two or three nights at least.
Okay. So there are a couple of things to do. Because these are, what happens is there's an induction phase of sleeping. And the induction phase is when we're between waking and sleeping. And these things occur if you look at it from a point of view, if you were, put into a sleep lab and you look at people who have it, it's during that induction phase between being aware and not being aware. And there actually are people who try to control their dreams where they're in that space that's in between. But for the most part, people really can't control their dreams. I mean, they, you know, are unconscious, then goes and controls it. And you happen to be aware of it, and it wakes you up and puts you into that consciousness. So one of the things you want to look at is caffeine. How much coffee do you drink?
I don't drink coffee.
Okay. So you want to look at caffeine. You want to look at alcohol. You want to look at any inebriant drugs, pot or anything else, because they also
drink alcohol.
Because they can also affect sleep. So any chemicals in your body can be part of it. If it bothers you, the first thing I would look at is melatonin, and decide whether or not I would take it. Especially if it's happening once every month or two, and you're not that bothered by it, I wouldn't bother with it. I would just, you know well, it's one of those things. If you can get back to sleep, because you know what it is once you get into consciousness. But if not, melatonin is the first thing I would look at. Easy, cheap, inexpensive. Buy a name brand of a store. That's what I recommend. You know, Costco, CVS, Walmart, Walgreens, all those places. You can get it inexpensively. Or I like to go to consumerlab.org, pay 20 $25 for the year and get a melatonin that's tested, because otherwise you don't know if you're really getting enough melatonin. And then you try it on the bottle. You take one or two or three tablets. That would be the first step. If that fails and you're still bothered in the middle of this, another possibility is talking another possibility is an over-the-counter sleep aid such as Benadryl, you know, Tylenol PM and the others.
Hooked on.
And you don't want to be hooked on it. But sometimes if you're in a flare, that or the drug called doxepin or trazodone, which are antidepressants in very small doses, can help realign the sleep mechanism.
And what was the second one?
Trazodone, T-R-A-Z-O-D-O-N-E. And don't quote me on misspelling because I misspell all the time. I'm from a family of inveterate misspellers. Nobody ever read in my family. They just watch television. So I know how to pronounce, but I can't spell. Or doxepin, D-O-X-E-P-I-N. They come in 6-milligram tablets, but they're very expensive. The 10-milligram ones work well, and they're cheap. And sometimes just taking that for 2 to 3 weeks I think restabilize the sleep mechanism, then you get off of it, and then for a day or two, you know, you'll see whether or not you need it. You're not hooked on it. These are not habit-forming, so they're not the same as the Z drugs such as Zolpidem, which is Ambien. And I would try those if the melatonin failed, and then I would go back to it. If it happened, you know, you've lived with it your whole life, it's that it's happening more often and you want to sort of reset things. And it does run in families, and sleepwalking runs in families too. You know, I used to sleepwalk, but I haven't done that for years.
I only did as a child. I wouldn't have any bearing related to like from age 22 to 36, I was diagnosed with psychomotor epilepsy. It wouldn't.
I don't think, you know, your mom had it, your grandmother had it. It's just, you know, you inherit these things about it, and it's how disturbing is it? It's during that induction phase. So I would try that. I would, you know, there are no drugs you have to stop. Try melatonin first and get a good melatonin. If that fails, consider taking doxepin or trazodone for a short period for a couple of weeks just to stabilize things. So then it goes back to where it happens once every other month. And that you can live with because you've been living with it.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for the call at 800-462-7413. Before we get back to the phone, Zorba, deep breathing.
Oh, gosh. Oh, gosh. Here we go again. Well, Fergus, do you ever take deep breaths?
I should, and I don't.
Why should you?
Because it's calming, I think, to deep
breathe. So you're never, so you're always calm? You don't feel like
I'm never calm.
That's what I mean.
That's why I should do deep breathing.
But, you know, it's the first thing you do, at least when I do, if I go to a meditation class or yoga class, they do. Let's take a deep cleansing breath. Well, have I been breathing foul air? Where's the cleansing breath come? Take a deep breath in. And then I take it out. A deep breath in. I'm going to put people to sleep.
It does feel
second.
Good. It does feel good.
And I'm going to do that. So, you know, why does it feel good? Well, we've been looking, scientists have been looking for some time to figure out exactly what it is. And guess who they looked in to find it out? Mice. Mice, our friends.
Do mice deep
our
breathe?
Friends in the animal kingdom.
This group of mice, I want you to deep breathe.
That's
this
right.
group,
that's
don't
right.
deep breathe.
They were teaching mice. It sort of seems like that. But anyway, they've been looking for neurons actually within the brainstem that are responsible for breathing, because we don't have to think about breathing. And in fact, when I was up in the Himalayas and crossed a really high pass, you know, 18,500 feet. That is definitely high. But before I went over the pass, I would have this breathing, which is high altitude breathing, where all of a sudden you stop breathing for maybe 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and then you do catch-up breathing. And it's Chain-Stokes breathing. That's what it's called. And I remember thinking, I'm just going to breathe normally because I don't like the way this is. But you can't do that. You can only breathe. You know, you can only think about breathing so much, and then the neurons take over. But they found the neurons. They think in the brain. And what they did was they took neurons. They took them in some mice. And some mice, they destroyed the neurons. And other mice, they kind of stimulated the neurons. Mm-hmm. And then they put the mice in situations which would make them scared. Now, what would you make you scared if you were a mouse?
A cat.
That's right. You don't really have to think very hard about that. You would. So the mice that had the neurons, you know, which, you know, were deep breathing, they look kind of relaxed. You know, they're kind of hanging out, not doing very much, just sitting around smoking cigarettes. You know how mice do, you know. Yeah. Give them a cigarette and they'll smoke. You've seen those mice smoke. They're, you're over in the corner smoking while the cat's around. I've really got this Walt Disney thing sitting around. Whereas the other mice were scared. And so they think that they have discovered the neurons in the brain that may be responsible for deep breathing. Now, why does it calm you? You'd have to ask the mice to actually get the answer of why it actually calms you. But we know now where the neurons are, and the mice have led the way to that. And I just want to thank our furry creatures.
Doesn't it calm us because it somehow feeds the brain to breathe deeply?
Feeds the brain with what?
With
you're
deep,
getting enough
deep,
oxygen.
With deep...
If not, you'd be short of breath, and you'd be going, ha, ha. You know what short of breath is, right?
I mean,
we've all been short. I mean, everyone's been short of breath. So why would it feed the brain? Feed the brain with more oxygen?
Well, it's a calming thing.
You sound so calm, exactly. That's it. Well, anyway, the mice have led it. Basically, whether deep breathing actually is regulating these neurons and making a difference, no one really knows. But my recommendation is if you're anxious, if you're upset, what you do is take one deep breath and think of those mice just relaxing next to a cat.
800-462-7413.
So let's take our next call.
A listener with us in Concord, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, hello.
How can we help?
I have a question about taking medication that is, well, I'm a post-gastrectomy patient, and I have been prescribed gabapentin and OxyContin.
Mm-hmm. Post-gastrectomy for what? Took out your stomach for?
I had stomach cancer.
And when was that? When did you have your surgery?
About a year and a half ago.
And everything looks good?
Yeah. I'm cancer-free.
You're so lucky. What sort of symptoms did you have?
I thought I had an ulcer. I was having abdominal pain at night, and my doctor was pretty convinced it was going to be an ulcer also.
Sure. Common. Ulcers are common, and stomach cancer in our country is not that common.
So I was having, like, intense abdominal pain at night and, some other symptoms. And so my doctor did a colonoscopy and an endoscopy, and they did a biopsy. And he said he thought everything looked pretty good. And then, of course, a couple of days later, I get the call.
Jeez, holy cow.
But, so they were based on where the cancer was. They had to remove the entire stomach, they couldn't save it.
First of all, you are very, very, very lucky to be alive with this.
I feel very lucky. Yeah. They told me it was an aggressive cancer, and that was in the month of June, and they said if I didn't find it when I did, I would have been gone by December.
Yeah, no, you had good symptoms. You had a good doctor. You had a good relationship. You had good luck. All of it together. Now we'll get into your question, but I mean that's really something. Kudos to your doctor. Kudos. So, and to you.
I agree entirely. He just took a chance with the endoscopy with the last-second decision, and that's how he found it. The problem that I suffer with now is in order to eat, I have a lot of pain when I eat. And so they have me on my miracle drug, gabapentin, and a low dose of OxyContin. But I would like somehow to eliminate the OxyContin from my medicine intake. And
how much are you on? What's your dose?
I'm on the 5-325 milligram.
Oh, the OxyContin. So
5-325.
How many times a day?
Well, he has prescribed 3 times a day, but I have self-cut back on the dosage.
Okay.
And he's perfectly fine with that. I'm okay with being in a little bit of pain, so I take as the minimal amount. But the problem that I have is I would like to eliminate it entirely. Sure. However, when I have tried, the pain just gets too intense, even though I'm taking a minuscule amount. And I've tried even upping the gabapentin in lieu of taking the oxycodone or whatever.
How much gabapentin are you? What's your dose?
200 milligrams, 4 times a day.
And you can go up to 2,400 milligrams a day of gabapentin.
The thing is I work for a living,
and
it makes me groggy and such.
with gabapentin, I want to go to that for just a second. If you do it slowly, a lot of people tolerate higher doses. And so you might tolerate going to the gabapentin from an anti-seizure drug good for neuropathic pain. If you move it up slowly over time, you might be able to tolerate 300 – you know, you might be able to tolerate another 300 or 400 milligrams a day or even more. And that might be part of it. It might be part of what works. I don't know. Gabapentin is a good drug to work with. You might not tolerate it, but that would be – kind of one thing out of the box I would look at and see if I could tolerate it over time. And I would increase the dose at bedtime or when you're home first, and then if you tolerate that, start the daytime dose. And then what I would do with the oxycodone that you're on, I would break it in half.
I've been doing that. I'd like to take – I've tried – like I said, I've tried eliminating it entirely, but that doesn't quite work. I end up in a lot of pain again. Mm-hmm. And I can't take any NSAIDs because I have renal failure. Oh. So, you know, I'm trying to play with the medication, but I was wondering if you knew of anything that else that I could possibly substitute with the gabapentin that's non-narcotic.
No, gabapentin's a good drug. I would stick right with it.
Okay.
Good drug, good generic. I would slowly increase the gabapentin and see what that did, and I would increase it as much as I could tolerate it. And once I said people, it takes them a week or two to tolerate it, and usually they go, I can stand it, I can tolerate it, and then they go higher. Lyrica is another drug in that class. It's different than gabapentin, more expensive because it's name brand. It is slightly different, and you might go to that, but if the gabapentin is working, I would push that up. And then with the oxycodone, once again, it's, you know, you've got pain. You're a good example of somebody who might need it on a regular basis, and the answer is you just use the minimal amount that you need.
Yeah.
But you are very, very lucky. Very, very lucky to be here and to be around and have that. And, you know, you're still really in a healing mode with something like this, you know. And in many ways, we're in uncharted territory. We don't really understand chronic pain in people who have had a gastrectomy, you know, any abdominal, intra-abdominal pain. And if there's anyone out there, you know, in the vast public radio has got some ideas, go to zorbapastor.org and send it to us. Because there may be people who are listening right now who have gastrectomy. So go to zorbapastor.org and give suggestions, and we'll let you know.
Thank you, Dr. Zorba.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. At 800-462-7413. Now, before the break, Zorba, it seems like a good time to acknowledge a pretty important milestone here at Zorba Pastor on Your Health. You and I have been at this for quite some time. Believe it or not, this year marks our 25th year.
No, I don't believe it.
It does.
We've only been doing this for 6 years.
Carl proved it to us.
How did Carl prove it? Okay, show me the money. By
digging through the archive room, unearthing a dusty box of old Zorba Pastor on Your Health cassette tapes, and he put together a few snippets from our very first show in January of 1992. Zorba, let's break out the 25-year-old single malt scotch and enjoy this sonic trip back to our very first show. This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Hello again, I'm Tom Clark. Each week at this time, we'll be bringing you Dr. Zorba Pastor. He'll be here to answer your questions on the phone, your questions about health and medicine.
I have a question about the new skin patch that I've read about to help people stop smoking.
That would be an excellent alternative. The patches are coming out on the market. They should be available sometime this month. The cost for the patch will be about the same as the cost for a pack of cigarettes, so they won't be cheap because cigarettes aren't cheap. They're over $2 a pack.
I'm Tom Clark with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Dr. Pastor, what about lead poisoning and that wrapper around the wine?
Well, let's talk about lead from two sources, the wrapper and the goblet that you're drinking it from. If you happen to have a lead decanter at home that's filled with port or whiskey, I mean, I don't know anyone who does, but I've always seen it in the movies, that there's a tremendous amount of lead that leaches out, and you shouldn't be drinking anything out of that. Now, let's jump step to the wine wrapper.
Yeah.
When you pull that wrapper off, that foil wrapper happens to be lead. If you take it and give it to your child, they're going to get lead
lead poisoning if they chew on it. And it turns out that there are lead, there's lead dust that's left on the top of the wine bottle. The recommendation now is to take the top of it and wipe it off with a cloth. Interestingly enough, the California wineries have jumped on the bandwagon right away and said they are going to phase out lead wrappers. And so there will not be lead wrappers on California wine, as far as I know it, after 1992 or 1993. They've decided to get rid of it. I think it's important to wipe the top of the wine bottle. I don't think you have to get rid of the expensive wine.
Before we take the break, what's this all about, Dr. Pastor, and why in the world would we be doing recipes in a program that deals with health and medicine?
When we're talking about good health, we can't talk about good health without exercise and without proper nutrition. So on every show, we're going to give a recipe from my tried and tested kitchen, a healthful recipe which will more or less be for fruit or vegetable or some other food that you may not have thought was useful.
That's coming up in just a minute, right here on the very first broadcast of Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Dr. Pastor, it's been fun. We look forward to next week, the same time.
You bet, Tom.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this last hour, we can sell you one.
Oh, my goodness.
I can't believe it. And I can't believe my voice. In other words, I'm still talking as quickly as I did 25 years ago. And your voice, you sound great, Tom. You sound awesome.
In 1992, I sounded
awesome? Yeah, you sound awesome. You still sound awesome. You sound the same.
Okay. That recipe, by the way, is coming up along with, it's a different recipe.
Yeah, I hope so.
More of your calls, another interesting topic to talk about right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here again with Public Radio's favorite family doc, Zorba Pastor.
How do you know I'm the favorite family doc? I mean, you've been saying that for years.
No, I said Public Radio's favorite.
Oh, Public Radio, yeah.
Yeah, well, you could be everybody else's.
I'm everybody's favorite family doc? I mean, you know, it's been years. I expect to go up in value as time goes on, but please, go on.
Can we do the recipe?
Of course, we can do the recipe.
First, let the callers know what our number is, 800-462-7413. And now, corn and cucumber salad with feta and basil.
Do you think any of our callers have us on speed dial so they can call us up at any time? All right, I'll get off the recipe. I'm sorry.
We're the same callers then.
But I'm waxing nostalgic. We've been doing this for 25 years. I can't believe it. And I'm still the same age, but it's 25 years. You know, people ask me in the office, when are you going to retire? And I go, I'm only halfway through my career.
I'm trying to think of how many trips to the doctor have I had?
In these 25 years.
Yeah. Do the recipe.
Okay. Corn. Do you like corn?
I do.
Cucumbers.
Yeah, cucumbers.
Do you like feta?
Yeah.
I like feta. Do you like basil?
I do. I like it all.
See, so it's all
just
good.
Put it all together, and that's the recipe.
It's actually pretty simple. Now, yeah. I'm going to talk a bit. We talk out with 3 cups of corn kernels, okay?
If you
can get them fresh, but who can get them fresh in the wintertime?
That's hard, yeah.
So you're either going to use canned or you're going to use frozen.
Oh, frozen. It has to be frozen.
Well, there's a certain canned corn that I like, which is Green Giant Mexicana Niblets, I think it's called, which is a fresh pack, and it doesn't have water around the corn kernels, and I find it really, really good. I find it very, very tasty. But if you can get frozen, it's better. Now, we use Muriel Stoneman's corn. Do you know who she is?
No. Well, is she your neighbor?
Well, Muriel used to be our neighbor, but she has since passed away. And the Stoneman Farm raises corn. And we, in the wintertime, I make maybe
25 packages, pine packages of corn. Oh, it is the best corn in the world. Mm. So if you can freeze fresh corn from the summer and put it in your freezer, this salad will taste even
better. Or can they call and ask you?
Absolutely. If you call 1-800, what's the number again?
462-7413.
You call that number, ask me to send you a Muir Stoneman's frozen corn. And maybe I will.
You're going to get calls.
Maybe I won't. Two cups of grape tomatoes halved.
Tomatoes halved.
Now, I missaid that. I said graped. I gave it in the past tense.
I said grape tomatoes.
No, but I said graped. But any small tomato works. Yeah. It's going to take a while to get through this recipe. It's very clear that I'm spreading it out.
I'm really tired after 25 years.
After 20 years, I can barely get through the recipe. This is so tough. I'm just slogging up the hill. We're just walking. Six to eight medium red radishes halved and thinly sliced.
Medium red radishes, halved and thinly sliced.
That's right. Now, do you like radishes?
Oh, I love radishes. You don't find them anywhere. You go out to a restaurant.
No, they're not around. A lot of people don't like radishes. Penny doesn't like radishes. Vanessa, my daughter, doesn't like radishes. Dee Dee doesn't like radishes.
I love them, and I haven't had them in years.
Really? Yeah. Oh, you can buy them. You can buy them pre-washed next to the carrot counter. I eat them for lunch. I love radishes.
Okay.
Large cucumber sliced.
A large cucumber sliced.
Now, you may pick the English burpless cucumber. Now, every time I look at that, I think, do cucumbers give me burps? Do you burp when you eat cucumbers?
I don't recall burping eating cucumbers.
No, but they call it burpless. So I think the English are always, English are always worried about gas. They are. My grandmother was English. She was always worried about gas. She would pass some gas and she would titter. She would go, she'd kind of laugh.
If you're English, don't pay any attention.
Well,
but the other
grandparents were Polish. And they never worried about gas.
Okay.
There really was a difference, gas. Okay, medium shallot sliced.
A medium shallot sliced.
And you could use a green onion instead.
Okay.
3 ounces of feta cheese crumbled.
3 ounces of feta cheese crumbled.
That's right. 1/4 cup of loosely packed basil leaves.
1/4 cup loosely packed basil leaves.
You can pretty much get basil almost anywhere in this country, anytime. Used to be tough.
Yeah.
And now here's the dressing. 2 tablespoonfuls of balsamic vinegar.
2 big tea balsamic vinegar.
Tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
A big tea extra virgin olive oil.
2 teaspoons of Dijon mustard.
2 little tea Dijon mustard.
Some kosher salt and freshly ground black pepper you're going to use. Okay, let's make it. So for the salad, combine the corn, the tomatoes, the radishes, the cucumber, the shallot or green onion, feta cheese, basil in a large bowl. Toss it up gently to combine. Then for the dressing, combine the balsamic vinegar, olive oil, Dijon mustard in a small bowl. Sealable container. Whisk it well. Shake it vigorously until it's smooth and emulsified. I have a little whisk that I use for this. Mm-hmm. Season with some salt and pepper again. Shake it, pour it over the salad, toss the ingredients, and voila. And then you garnish it with the basil leaves. Very important. Put the basil leaves on top when it's all done. You've got a wonderful salad. Easy, quick to make, tasty because you've got corn, sweet corn. You've got, think about it, cucumber. It has a different texture to it. And then you've got feta and basil. And, of course, the radishes in there give it that sort of pungent, kind of a almost bitter taste.
If somebody wants this, can we sell them this recipe?
Yeah, like in the old days, we sell them the recipe. What did we sell them for? Where did we get that idea? I don't remember ever charging anyone except maybe a postage stamp. Yes, go to ZorbaPastor.org. God, 25 years ago, who thought of the Internet? Right?
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. Who thought of the Internet? I mean, the Internet existed. It was invented by Al Gore, but who thought of it 25 years ago? That's ZorbaPastor.org. Facebook. My goodness, think about it. If we had just gone and put our money, instead of taking it from public radio and put it into Microsoft 25 years ago, we would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But
we'd still be doing the show.
Absolutely, because it would be close to our house. It's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget Facebook. And who knows, 25 years in the future, what you will do to get this recipe.
800-462-7413. To the phones we go. Jacksonville, Florida with us. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Okay. At the end of January, my 22-year-old woke up in the wee hours of the morning gasping for air, convinced she was having a heart attack.
Oh.
But I couldn't talk her into going to the emergency room.
Okay.
So we took her to the doctor the next morning. he said she had an irregular heartbeat and sent her to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They weren't concerned at all. 23-year-olds, apparently, you know, he's like, oh, you're fine, basically.
But they said go to the emergency room because of an irregular heartbeat?
Right. Mm-hmm. And at the hospital, he decided the EKG was not irregular enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So go figure.
No, they look at the EKG, they look at the rhythm, and there's some rhythms
right.
that are bad rhythms and some rhythms that are variations of normal that are okay. And we used to treat all arrhythmias with drugs. And then many years ago, probably 20 years ago, we discovered that the treatment for what we now call benign arrhythmias were killing people. It was a drug called Quinidex, which is quinidine that we gave, another one, a number of other drugs that also were antiarrhythmic drugs that we used to give people, but it turned out they were actually bad for them. So had an EKG was done, discharged from the emergency room.
Right, but she was still gasping for air and having this pain mm-hmm. where her heart is. So it was kind of terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went back to the GP the next day, and he sent her to a cardiologist.
Okay, good choice.
And they did a whole cardiac workup and found that, well, there were abnormalities. It wasn't anything life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, at, I guess, the end of February, they get around to doing a chest CT. Good
mm-hmm.
grief.
Okay.
I couldn't come up with the words.
Mm-hmm.
So after the chest CT, they acted really weird. And we're like, well, we've got to call the doctor before you can leave.
Okay.
And, of course, they did it at the hospital because of her allergies. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants you to die. And
what did the chest CT show?
Pneumonia.
So she had a pneumonia. Huh. And they treated her for the pneumonia?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that apparently cleared up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they're convinced everything should be fine. Well, she managed to control the anxiety that comes from the little stabby pain
mm-hmm.
and isn't gasping constantly anymore. But her heart rate is extremely irregular. I went and bought an oximeter.
Uh-huh.
And both her pulse and her O2 levels are all over the board.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go back a bit. Her O2 levels she's not a smoker. Is that correct, or she is a smoker?
No, she's
okay.
not.
If you're not a smoker, your oxygen levels should be somewhere above 95, 96. And they may vary a little bit, but on an oximeter, which measures it, you put it on your finger, it can vary if there's an irregular pulse, you know, on the oximeters you buy for $30. It may show that your oxygen is moving around, when in reality it probably isn't. It's a measurement issue with the oximeter. But when you've got an irregular pulse, sometimes it doesn't. It averages, and sometimes it'll be a little bit off. But it ought to be above 95 or 96. But getting back to her symptoms, that's kind of the question. If she had a complete cardiac workup, including a Holter monitor, and she's got benign arrhythmias, they're not benign if they're still symptomatic. So have the cardiologists recommended, how much coffee does she drink?
Really none.
Okay, so because caffeine can be an issue. Alcohol, illegal drugs, anything? Does she smoke pot or drink much alcohol?
Nope.
Does she exercise on a regular basis?
Not anything drastic. She does a little yoga.
I have a couple of suggestions for her. Suggestion number one, the best thing for your heart when you've got an irregular heart with a benign arrhythmia is aerobic exercise. That's number one, number two, number three. And 12 weeks, you will see a difference. It may take that long. And I'm talking about an exercise program where she gets her heart to 80% of her maximal heart rate for 20 minutes, 3 days a week for 12 weeks. And I would say chances are very, very likely that the arrhythmia that she has will no longer bother her. There may still be some arrhythmia, but because she'll have increased cardiac reserve, she will no longer have the symptoms. That's the issue. Benign arrhythmias are common. The symptoms are what we want to get rid of. If that fails, low-dose beta blockers such as propranolol, 20 milligrams twice a day, can make a big difference and once again get rid of the symptoms of the arrhythmia. But I would not go to that first. The first thing I would go
right.
to is I would get to aerobic exercise, because that's a very, very important thing. If her pneumonia is
right.
cleared up, you can do that with a chest x-ray. They probably do not have to do the repeat CT. But I'm not convinced that was the thing that really brought her to the ER that much before that. There may have been something else going on. But making sure she did not have a pulmonary emboli MRI, which is probably why they did the CT, was an important thing to do. But she needs to be on an aerobic exercise program. That is the natural way to really take care of this.
Okay.
Let us know what happens. That would be very, very good.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. Thanks. At 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, we've learned over the years that our listeners don't always agree with you. So get ready to get yelled at again. Here's another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
The following email came to us from a listener named Sandy. She writes, Dr. Pastor, with all due respect, you recently said no special shoes are needed for walking.
Did I say something grammar-wise with that? No special shoes are used for walking. Is this a grammar issue?
No.
Oh, okay. Just asking. I just wanted to know, because I'm listening thinking, do I have a grammar problem with this? Please, go
on. No, not a grammar, please.
You know, after 25 years, Tom, I have to double-think some of these things.
Anyway, she says, wrong. Walking shoes are very important. Walking for exercise requires shoes with good support and extra heel cushioning. If you walk a lot without those things, you'll destroy your heels.
I don't know about that. I mean, I don't know about that. You know, my grandfather on my father's side lived until 87. He walked and he never had an exercise shoe.
His heels weren't destroyed.
Let me tell you something. His heels were not destroyed. I'm sure he walked in the shoes. I walked in a kid's leather shoes that had the – remember leather shoes with the heel? That were kind of – now I think about it, that would hurt.
Yeah.
And just had a sole. I mean, those shoes – I mean, I call them dress shoes now, and I wear them and my feet hurt, but they're not destroyed. So, but I think you're better off with the cushioning. But I don't think you'll destroy your heel. I don't think you'll destroy your heel.
Did Zorba miss something? Feel free to put your foot down by posting on our Facebook page or sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or through Facebook.
Some research coming up. That's next. More of your calls, of course. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, our number. But before our next call, Zorba, what's this about genetic testing for disease risk?
Well, interesting idea. So first of all, the first question is it accurate? And what does it mean? Mm-hmm. And how do you use it? And the most common one is something called 23andMe. It's just the name of a company that did it. The FDA in 2013 did a cease and desist order. They said, wait a minute, you're selling a test to people. You don't really have the proper controls. You don't know what it means. They don't know what it means. And we don't think it's a good idea. Which I think was good. I think it was good for the FDA to step in and say, you've got to put some order to this. And the question is, what do you do about it? But let's talk about that second.
Yeah.
You can now get genetic testing. 23andMe, they will test for, quote, 10 diseases. Things such as blood clotting disorders, Gaucher's disease, factor 11 disease. Some of these things that actually have some accurate tests. Quote, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, right? Mm. Whether or not you can really test for this is really open to question. But people can now do it. Spit into a tube, pay $200. You'll get back something that'll say whether or not you'll get the disease. Slam bang, go to your doctor, and what are you going to do?
Yeah, but is it at all accurate?
Well, that is really the question. So we don't have, to my knowledge, a disease that's accurate for Alzheimer's disease. So they go, you're at risk. Well, what does that mean? What is the risk? Is it 5%, 25%, 100%? What does it mean? For Parkinson's, there are some factors that may put you at risk. Well, if you have a family history of Parkinsonism, that puts you at risk. What does it mean? Now, some of the diseases that we'll say, which are hemophiliac-type diseases where they're going to test for, blood diseases, they're accurate, but you're going to kind of know if you have it or not, you know, and whether or not you have this gene may make a difference or may not in your children, but you're going to get your children tested. So the long and the short of it is, I don't really know if this is good, and I've never been for this. I've never been for the trucks that go around and test you for other things such as calcium in your, you know, around your heart. I'm not for that kind of thing.
Let's say the Alzheimer's test is accurate, which we don't know. Right?
It's not accurate.
Oh, it's not.
It's not. Let's say it's accurate. It's not accurate.
Okay.
The Parkinson test is not accurate.
Okay.
Some of the other blood tests are accurate. And then the issue is privacy.
I was just going to say, what would you do anyway?
Well, what would you do? And then there are the privacy issues.
If you knew
issues.
That, what
well,
would you do?
Well, but let's say the information is out there, and let's say that indeed we find out that some of these things are accurate. And let's say, for instance, the insurance companies are then allowed to get it because they sell the information. What does it do for you in the future? Does it actually raise your rates? You know, with all the stuff that's going on and with privacy, I think this is an important issue before you have any testing done. Buyer beware.
800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Knoxville, Tennessee. How can we help?
I have a question about dietary supplements, and I'll give you a little background. I'm a middle-aged female with slowing metabolism and all that goes along with that. And I'm hearing a lot about, and some of my friends have recommended, dietary supplements, biotin, green superfood, collagen, things like that. And I'm just wondering if Dr. Zorba, if you can talk about the safety, the effectiveness, and there's so many different sources out there. And a lot of times I'll read in a magazine, and when I get to the bottom line, I see that it's an advertisement
for one or more of these.
And so they're selling you product.
Right.
Exactly. And I know that the ideal is to get the right amount of vitamins and nutrients from food, but if I eat everything that's necessary to get the nutrients, then I'm going to be a lot heavier than I need to be. I'm going to gain weight. So,
Well, let's talk about that for just a second. Do you take any supplements now?
No, I don't.
So your friends are saying you should take supplements?
Well, they recommended, I know one that has the green superfood and one that takes oral collagen, one that takes oral biotin, you know, for thinning hair or you know, energy levels, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And again, it's all sort of, you know, something that I'm not really accustomed to. It just seems like when I hit 50, some of these things started happening, and you talk about it with your friends, both male and female friends. You know,
you bring up some good points. First of all, I used to think certain supplements were good. I now believe these are all industrialized products under sham names of Mother Nature and Natural. So they're industrialized. In other words, a company goes, says we're going to make biotin. They put it in a product. They sell it in a pill. They put a nice label on. They charge you $25 a month. And then they say you're going to get more energy from it. And we're talking about an industry that's $3 to $5 billion. We're not talking about a small amount of money. And then we'll say, well, like you said, logically, I'm not going to eat the right food every single day, which is true. I mean, I don't eat the right food every single day. There are a couple of things that I think are important. I have never seen any double-blind placebo-controlled trials that show that there's any supplement that improves your memory and gives you more energy. I've never seen it. If there's one out there, I want to see it. And if there's a memory thing out there that really works, I'm going to take it because I would like my memory. Everyone wants their memory to be better. Nobody says, give me less memory. You know, nobody's ever looking for that. They're all looking for the golden thing. So from a dietary point of view, the king of diets is the Mediterranean diet. Plenty of fruits and vegetables, fish twice a week. You can go and Google the Mediterranean diet. The enriched Mediterranean diet, a handful of nuts every single day is worthwhile, and some olive oil, an ounce of olive oil or 2 ounces of olive oil, any way you can get it. That's the enriched Mediterranean diet. It reduces the risk of Alzheimer's. reduces the risk of dementia, reduces heart attack and stroke. It's the right way to eat. So that's what I would look at. That's number one. If you want a minimal supplement, a multivitamin that says USP, 100% of your minimum daily requirement, house brand is cheap, and vitamin D, 2,000 milligrams. And the reason is vitamin D is still the one supplement that is still may be useful to prevent a number of things. So I'm still pro vitamin D unless it's proven otherwise. The initial data looks good, and an aspirin tablet. Aspirin has now been shown to reduce the risk of heart attack, stroke in many people, and cancer of the colon. So those are the three supplements, multivitamin, vitamin D, and aspirin. Those are the ones I would recommend. And the problem with supplements that we often have is say, well, our diet isn't good, we'll take supplements. And the answer is improve our diet. In other words, you don't want supplements to be the excuse for not going to Mother Nature. It's plentiful fruits and vegetables that are colorful. The more colorful they are, the more vitamins, nutrients, and micronutrients they have. And the more natural they are. So when you're looking at carrots, those carrots that you can now buy in stores that have a variety of colors, they have different beta carotene. One of those beta carotenes is going to be different. When you buy beta carotene in supplement, it's an industrialized, manufactured product of beta carotene. Carrots contain 16 to 20 different kinds of beta carotene. No manufacturer knows which one is better. Mother Nature does.
Thank you.
You're
That's
welcome.
Helpful.
You're welcome.
Great.
Go eat your carrots.
We appreciate the call. Thank you. Now, Zorba, let's tackle another listener email.
Okay, no, where's the music? We don't have email music.
No.
Why not? Carl, where's our email? Who knew? We needed email music. You see, he's got his hands up.
It's time once again
for
our email. Email time once again. Time once again
for our email music.
Anyway, this one comes to us from David in Williamsville, New York.
You know, maybe a typewriter thing.
David writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I enjoy your column, but your recent reference to tuna salad on whole wheat hit a nerve. A number of years ago, we visited our son, who lives out of state, and had lunch together. He ordered, as usual, a tuna sub from Subway. I note at my local Subway how many heavy people order the tuna. I think there is the impression that it is low in calories. Checking the caloric value online, I learned it was tied for highest of all the subs at 960 calories. I think Subway does not do enough to make the caloric value of the tuna sub clear and feeds the impression to heavy people that it is healthy and fresh. What's your take on this?"
Well, first of all, it is fresh. That's number one.
Yeah.
No, I've known for years that tuna happens to be the highest caloric. By the way, the 960 is the 12-inch sub. Very important to remember. That's the foot-long sub.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people take the foot-long sub and they say, "Give me some mayo on it." They're
Yeah.
Yet another, you know, 150, 200 calories. No, first of all, companies should make the calories available. But you know what? They're interested in selling product. So people have to be aware. The BMT sub, which is made out of sausage and turkey, whatever it's put in there, happens to be a much lower calorie sub. And when you look at it, you want the cheese, you're adding another 100 calories to it. So this is where we have to become aware of what the calories are when we go into restaurants. Yeah. This is called public radio education.
Yeah. So David in Williamsville, New York has helped out with this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, David, for pointing that out. But remember, it's the 12-inch sub you're talking about, David.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Tune in to our show, and you might hear an answer. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And before we sign off, Zorba, we always love it when our listeners chime in with helpful information. The following note came to us from a University of Wisconsin professor named Thatcher. "Dear Zorba, your segment on fluoride in toothpaste and other treatments was very good coverage. However, you'll be interested to know that Pepsodent, now has fluoride at the same 0.24% level common in other toothpastes. Well, I do remember it from way back when you and I were kids as not having fluoride when other brands were making it a value-added ingredient. Now, almost everyone includes fluoride as being routine. In fact, nowadays, only a few specialty health food toothpastes don't have fluoride, and they make it a marketing feature for their anti-additive clientele. I always enjoy your show. I also really appreciate your open attitude to corrections or updates, whether relating to content or to grammar. It is a great model on how to be knowledgeable and still keep an open mind, learning all the time. We can hope more people become like this.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a very nice compliment. Now, as for toothpaste, I don't know if Sensodyne, I'd have to look at the label, has fluoride. Mm-hmm. Sensodyne is a common toothpaste, and I don't think they have fluoride, but I don't really know. I think they have, if they do have fluoride, I believe they have stuff, they have toothpaste also without fluoride. Mm-hmm. One thing people can do if they're worried that fluoride also is affecting them and producing a rash is talk to the pharmacist, because there are non-fluoride toothpaste in every, you don't have to go to a specialty store. There are non-fluoride toothpaste in every pharmacy. But thank you very much. Very nice. Yep. Very nice.
Have a helpful tip for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Ready to start our next 25 years?
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast,
visit us on the web at ZorbaPastor.org. Or find us in Facebook.
Or call us at
1-800-462-7413.
Yeah, very good. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin
Public
Radio.
Notice I wasn't really sure about that.
It only took you 25 years. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidman. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark.
Here for the next 25 years, Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0422Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.